Time for the Big Picture program with Abu Dawji. We welcome him on the line. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Is that the Mufti?
Yes.
Oh, so nice to speak to you again after so long and all.
How are you doing?
Alhamdulillah, things in Durban are fabulous.
Always
fabulous,
good.
Alhamdulillah.
The story that caught your eye.
Well, before I get there, Mufti, you know, I had a strange encounter this morning. At 5 a.m. while preparing for this program, I got I received a picture on WhatsApp of a hand holding a cup of coffee. And on the coffee cup, there were some French word and the word Canada. Canada. The message was from Maulana Rawat. I couldn't make head or tail what this photo was all about. Then he said that it's 11:30 p.m. And I asked him where he was, and he said that he was in Montreal in Canada. Good heavens, he was having coffee late at night. Then he sent me a voice message in which he was trying to impress me with his French, because in Montreal they speak French. And his first word was, bonjour. I wondered what that meant. And then I realized that you were saying hello, bonjour, bonjour. Then he said, okay, Habibi, do a good program. S'il vous plaît. That's what he said. S'il vous plaît. Now, I wonder what this voice was. Was he having a bride or something? And, you know, that took me a minute to figure out. He was saying please in French, which is s'il vous plaît. And then he said goodbye. Something like, au revoir. What was he trying to say? Well, actually, he was saying, au revoir, au revoir. I can't wait for Molano to come back and speak French to us. Anyway, the story that caught my eye. I've just got one story that was quite strange and amusing. But first, let me say that, you know, Mufti, people have all kinds of marital problems that sometimes lead to divorce. Serious problems, very serious problems, like maybe a man is womanizing, or the woman is abusive and not taking care of the kids, or something like that. Very serious stuff. Well, a woman in India was granted permission by a judge to divorce her husband. What was the problem? Well, it had to do with the toilet. So, did he leave the toilet in a bad state after using it? No, that was not it. So, did he restrict access to her from using the toilet? No, that was not it also. The answer, dear listeners, is there was actually no toilet. Let me read to you from this report. An Indian court has granted a woman permission to divorce her husband after he consistently refused to build a toilet in their home, forcing her to relieve herself in the open. Family court judge Rajendra Kumar Sharma in India's western Rajasthan state ruled on August 18th that a toilet was a necessity in every home and defecating in the open was disgraceful for society and torture for the woman. The judge said, in villages, women have to wait until sunset to answer nature's call. This is not only physical cruelty, but also outraging the modesty of a woman. People spend money buying tobacco, alcohol, and mobile phones, but are unwilling to construct toilets to protect the dignity of their family. Well, the woman's lawyer said that she was married in 2011 to a laborer and filed for divorce 4 years, citing cruelty by her husband as he was unable to provide the couple a toilet. Divorce under Indian law is granted once proof of cruelty, violence, or undue financial demands are proven in a family court. Media reports from Rajasthan, the Bilwara district where the woman lives, said she would now formally file for divorce. And here's some useless statistics. Over 60% of India's 1.25 billion people still defecate in the open, posing a significant risk of rape and sexual assault to women, in addition the exposure to infection. According to a recent government survey, more Indians owned a mobile more Indians owned a mobile telephone than had access to a toilet. Tens of millions of people relieving themselves in the open each morning, particularly along railway tracks, is a common sight across India and one highlighted by social and environmental activists. So there you are, folks. The marriage vows were broken, and they were changed, actually, until toilet do us part. Now to another story. You know, I'm really sad, very sad about what happened to a woman in America. She committed a very grave sin, Mufti.
Yes.
She took part in a lottery. She bought a lottery ticket. Very big guna she committed. Very, very bad. I feel so sorry for her. She bought a lotto ticket, and yesterday it was announced that she won $758 million.
Wow.
Well, in rand, 758, let me tell you what that is in rand. In rand, it is 111,000 million. Okay, folks, enough of that. Let me tell you exactly how much it is in rand. It's 10,011,967,200 rands. Whoa. That's a lot of money. So as I said, I feel so sorry for this woman. Eh? What a big guna she committed by winning this lottery. You know, if I won, by mistake, just accidentally, if I bought such a ticket, and I won this amount of money, I'll give it all away, man. All away. Every cent. I don't want any guna. But you know what? You know what? I should have taken up boxing, Mufti.
Yes.
Seriously, yeah. I should have taken up boxing. Right after high school, I should have taken up boxing. I should have started training. And today, I could be making some real nice halal money. Like the big fight tomorrow between Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor. Big fight tomorrow. Mayweather is expected to earn, a minimum of $200 million or maybe even up to $400 million. So $200 million is about 2.646 billion rands. And McGregor will get $100 million. That's about 1.323 billion rands. Wow. And that's for actual boxing, for boxing for 36 minutes. 36 minutes, 3 minutes around, and 12 rounds. And here's the best part, Mufti. Mayweather will get that amount whether he wins or loses. Huh. Sure. I should have taken up boxing. Got into the ring with McGregor, the bell for round one. And I get one punch and then just lie there flat and get counted out and then take my 2.646 billion rands and go home. Ish. Maybe I won't get a chance to spend the money. That one punch would just kill me one shot. But maybe I can still start training here. I can still start training right now. You see, Mayweather is 40 years old. And I'm just around, well, I would say around 45. So it's still not too late. I still got some chance. Ne, Maulana?
Absolutely. Certainly a very useful profession. So what's happening in Palestine? What's the latest on that
front? Well. Now, listeners, if you try to analyze the situation in the Middle East, if you try to make sense of it, you are liable to get a severe, severe headache. Who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? That's quite a challenge. And there are so many layers to all the conflicts, you know, one layer and then something else and more conspiracies. And so many alliances, eh? Some easy to make out, some of the alliances, and others under the table. Rivals, one minute, are not rivals, and enemies are not real enemies. Lots of underhand stuff, lots of self-interest, lots of double dealings, and in the end, sadly, the ordinary innocent people suffer, Muslims and others who live in the region. Let me give you a quick example. The Cold War between the Saudis and the Qatar is mainly over Qatar's relationship with Iran. One would expect that Turkey would be on the side of the Saudis on this issue. After all commentators say that there is an emerging danger, a power block, Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Hezbollah in Lebanon against the Gulf states the so-called Shia-Sunni divide. Well, let me read to you some headlines from articles that I came across yesterday. And it says here, here's one in the Telegraph newspaper, British Telegraph, said, Qatar defies Saudi Arabia by restoring diplomatic ties with Iran. Qatar has defied Saudi Arabia by strengthening its diplomatic ties with Iran rather than cutting them back as Saudi Arabia and its allies have demanded. And the next headline says, Saudi Arabia will be infuriated by Qatar's decision to resume ties with Iran. Analysts say Doha's amicable relationship with Tehran was one of the main reasons for the Saudi-led effort to blockade Qatar. This was in the Independent newspaper of Britain. The announcement by Qatar that it is restoring diplomatic relations with Iran is a very public indication that the confrontations between the Sunni states and the Gulf, now in its third month, not only shows no sign of ending, but looks set to escalate. And then we have this headline, which was on Al Jazeera. Javed Zarif says that, it says the Iranian Foreign Minister Javed Zarif on Wednesday said that delegates from Iran and Saudi Arabia will exchange diplomatic visits soon. In an interview with ISNA, Zarif said the visits could take place after the Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia ends in the first week of September. The visas have been issued for both sides to make this trip. And then you get this headline also. Turkey seeks Iran's alliance against Kurds as U.S. pull wanes. It says the symbolism was huge, as was the message that followed the highest level talks in almost 40 years between the Turkish and Iranian military commanders. Then an announcement by Turkish president of a new alliance, So as I said, don't make the mistake of seeing everything in clear black and white. There are 50 shades of gray. Don't blame one side and stick with that story against another, because suddenly you realize that the side that you are backing is involved in some shady business. Be on the side of the ordinary suffering people, the poor and the downtrodden. What's that African expression? When two elephants fight, the grass suffers. So, things are complex in the Middle East. And so it is also with the situation in Palestine. It's an absolute mess. Now, very importantly, there are two things that are happening there in Palestine right now in respect of the Palestinian people, both of which are to the benefit of Israel. Now, I explained some of it to you listeners a few weeks ago, but of course you were not paying attention. You know, it makes me very cross. I spend hours and hours researching a topic, but you have such a low attention span, so low. I think I'm going to give you all some Ritalin or something like that. So please switch the stove off, or if you are on your cell phone, Motabaji, then please switch it off, pour a cup of tea, sit down and pay attention. I'm not going to say this again, and at the end there's going to be a test. Khabardar if you get less than 50%. Okay, let's start the discussion and analysis. As I said, there are two things that are happening at the same time, both of which impact on the Palestinian people, and both are beneficial to Israel. Are you there, Mullah?
Yes, yes.
Now, I have to give a little bit of background to the listeners. I'm sure you've heard it many times, and all of you listeners are experts on the Palestinian issue, but very briefly, here's some background. Now, we have Gaza, which is a tiny strip of land, about 45 kilometers long, along the coast, the Mediterranean coast, and about 6 kilometers wide, and as we know, about 2 million Palestinians live in a tiny strip of land. It's on the southern part of Israel. The West Bank, on the other hand, is a larger piece of land, and it's on the border with Jordan, where Al-Aqsa is located in Jerusalem. And, of course, these two parts with Jerusalem makes up 22% of historic Palestine, Gaza, West Bank, and Jerusalem. And the rest of it is, 78% is Israel. Now, when Israel was created in 1948, there was a big war. And then Egypt managed to get control of Gaza, and Jordan managed to get control of the West Bank. In 1967, in the Six-Day War, Israel captured the whole thing, Gaza, West Bank, East Jerusalem, all of it. In 1993, there were peace talks and between the Palestinians and the Israelis. and Yasser Arafat was head of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And that organization was made up of many groups, like the biggest group was, of course, Fatah. So you can imagine if we had a South African Liberation Organization, and the biggest group there would be the ANC, then you get PAC and AZAPO and so on. So that's what it was, Palestine Liberation Organization, with the biggest group being Fatah in that group. So they had the peace talks, and then Yasser Arafat and his group came back from Tunisia, where they were stationed, and they took control of parts of the West Bank and the Gaza, and they were given a toy parliament. No more, it's called now the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It's now called the Palestinian Authority. It is now a government. It's got a toy parliament, and you've got all these people who call themselves MPs and so on. Anyway, Arafat died on the 11th of November 2004, and then the control of the Palestinian Authority went to Mahmoud Abbas. Okay, a little bit about the money. The goods that come into the West Bank are taxed and by Israel, of course, and this tax money is handed over to Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority, the government, the Palestinian so-called government. And so this is used to pay the Palestinian civil servants who are working in the West Bank and Gaza. It's for this, for teachers and schools, the hospitals, electricity, water, and so on. And even prisoners who were in Israeli jails previously, who are now in Gaza and so on, they are also given a monthly grant. So this money that comes in, the tax money, is spent by Palestinian Authority in the Gaza, very important, in Gaza and the West Bank. There's also a committee that's been set up by the Palestinian Authority and Israel, which controls who enters from Gaza for medical treatment. There's one entry point that is a Rafah crossing into Egypt, and the other one crossing is into Israel itself, two crossings there. There are a couple of other crossings also, but these are the two main ones. So, basically what the Palestinian Authority was doing was that it was controlling the security for Israel, making sure that none of the militant groups do anything, and they were very tough, especially on Hamas. Palestinian Authority was tough on Hamas. And the main guy there was a chap by the name of Mohammed Dahlan, a very tough guy, a thug, who was really smashing Hamas and locking them up and torturing them and so on. This was all claimed that he was doing. And, of course, Hamas was not part of this government because Israel said that Hamas is a terrorist organization. And but elections took place in 2006, and Hamas took part in these elections, the Palestinian elections in Gaza and the West Bank, and Hamas won, and Mohammed Dahlan and his thugs, of course, were in the Gaza, and they tried to capsize this whole result, and they were not, they were ready to stage a coup and take over Gaza, not let it go to Hamas. But Hamas was smart, and they managed to chase Mohammed Dahlan and his group out of the Gaza Strip, and they regarded him from then onwards as an arch enemy. So he went, Mohammed Dahlan went back to the West Bank, and while he was in the West Bank, he appeared to be a rival to Mahmoud Abbas, who he was quite close to previously, but now he was a rival. So in 2011, he was expelled from Fatah, the organization of which he was a member, and then he left from there and he went to Jordan and finally ended up in the UAE. So he was out of sight and he was lying low for a while. Now, Hamas was running Gaza because they won the election, and because they won, so Gaza was put under siege by Israel. Mahmoud Abbas was mainly ruling the West Bank, all right?
Yes.
Is that all clear?
Yes, sir, quite clear, very informative.
So there were many peace talks between the two sides, between Israel and the Palestinian Authority and so on, but they all failed. Of course, they all failed. And then you had this big thing called the so-called Arab Spring. And in Egypt, you had Morsi who won, and he was quite clearly against Israel. So he had to go, and then Sisi took over, and he had close ties with Israel. Still has, of course, and he closed the Rafah border, the border that between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. And so the siege became even worse. The siege was put there by Israel, And now Sisi also closed that entry point into Egypt, so things got very, very bad. And of course, he bombed the tunnels that people were using to get some aid into the Gaza, so Sisi bombed the tunnels. And then the Saudis, of course, were very nervous also. They were very worried that the winds of change would also blow in their direction. So they had to cozy up to Israel also. They had to smash Hamas. Both Sisi and the Saudis and Gulf State had to smash Hamas also. So immediately the Gulf State declared the Muslim Brotherhood a terror organization. Muslim Brotherhood was in Egypt and in the entire region. So Israel was, of course, against them also. And so the Saudis and the Gulf State also declared the Muslim Brotherhood to be, and of course the big one, they declared Hamas a terror organization. Whew, can you believe it, eh? Now, as I said, this year there have been two dramatic developments, both for the benefit of Israel. Have you got some time, sir? This is like a long story, Mufti.
Yes, sir. You can go ahead.
Okay. So I'll just carry on till maybe about 10 or 11 o'clock. Anyway, so as I said, two dramatic developments, both for the benefit of Israel. First one, Abbas was getting steadily fed up, right? Because he wanted complete control of the Palestinians. So he made an ultimatum. He sent an ultimatum to Hamas: give up complete control of Gaza. That's what he told them: give up control of Gaza to the Palestinian Authority. Otherwise, all the money that is flowing into Gaza from the Palestinian Authority will be cut off. Now, Hamas, of course, wouldn't agree to any terms and to give up the Gaza, because Hamas and Fatah have different agendas. Abbas is regarded as a sellout, and so on. So Abbas took some very serious steps. Let me read from the Al Monitor website. It says that the Palestinian Authority and Hamas have been engaged in a tug-of-war for some time now. The dispute entered a new stage on April 12th when President Mahmoud Abbas promised during a speech at the conference of Palestinian ambassadors in Bahrain to pressure Hamas to end the division. Right, so anyway, I'm just going to jump a little bit. The PA's measures began on April 4th with the government deducting 30 to 50% from the salaries of its employees in the Gaza Strip, followed by suspending social assistance to 630 families and preventing hundreds of cancer patients from accessing treatment in Jerusalem or Israeli hospitals. The PA, Palestinian Authority, stopped covering electricity payments to Israel on April 27. On April 28, Abbas approved the early retirement law, which forced an estimated 35,000 military personnel in Gaza to retire early. Most recently, in June, the government also cut the financial support for 277 former Hamas prisoners who were in Israeli jails, who are now in Gaza. So, Mahmoud Abbas took these steps, and Gaza, which was already a humanitarian disaster, is now in an even worse situation, Mufti. Worse. As you know, they only have about 2 or 3 hours of electricity and so on. It's boiling hot there at the moment. Fridges are not working, and air cons are not working, nothing. 2 or 3 hours, can you just imagine? Okay, now very quickly to part two. That's part one. Part one was about Mahmoud Abbas putting heavy pressure on Gaza, on Hamas itself, so that they would give total control to him, to Mahmoud Abbas. Now to part two. I hope the listeners are still paying attention. So suddenly, Mohammed Dahlan came onto the stage a few months ago. Now, as you know, the situation is that Egypt regarded Hamas as a terrorist organization, and Hamas regarded Dahlan as its arch enemy. Okay? That's what I told you already. Now, suddenly, Mohammed Dahlan comes onto the scene, and Hamas meets Dahlan in Cairo on June 4th. And, of course, Hamas is very desperate because the situation is very dire there. It's being strangled. Gaza is being strangled. So Dahlan said, don't worry, man. You know what? His idea was to take control of Gaza. So clearly he said, all right, I'm going to get a lot of aid coming into Gaza. Lots of aid, and everything's going to be fine. I'm going to make sure that it's all going to happen. And he offered money from UAE. And in fact, last week, the UAE, United Arab Emirates, they have already started donating $15 million per month $15 million per month, and this is going to continue. Now, when it comes to Egypt, Egypt said that Hamas was a terror organization, but suddenly Egypt changed its tune also. It has eased the restriction on Rafah, and it sent 1 million liters of diesel to the Gaza, because that's what's going to be running the electricity, power stations, and so on. So this is all part of the game. So what is the game plan? Let me read to you very quickly, Mufti, very quickly, very important. This is actually in the Haaretz newspaper, that's the Israeli newspaper. It says here, the Dahlan plan, without Hamas and without Abbas. So both these people are going to be made irrelevant, Hamas and Abbas. So what's the Dahlan plan? He said, while Israel counts the meager hours of electricity allocated each day to Gaza's 2 million people, a complex arrangement is being cooked up between the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Gaza, and Jerusalem. The purpose is to make Mohammed Dahlan, a political rival of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, government chief in Gaza, lift most of the closure imposed on the Strip by Egypt and Israel, build a new power station in Egyptian Rafah, funded by the UAE, and later build a port. If this political experiment succeeds, Abbas will be pushed into a dark corner, and Dahlan will act to take his place either by elections or de facto recognition of his leadership. Egypt is already sending diesel fuel to Gaza at market prices, but without the taxes imposed by the Palestinian Authority. The UAE has earmarked $150 million to build a power station, and Egypt will soon gradually open the Rafah crossing to people and goods. It's still too early to assess whether this plan will be fully implemented and if Hamas will agree to place Dahlan at the head of the Gaza government, a step that could all but sever Gaza from the West Bank. Very important this is, especially given the long feud between Abbas and Dahlan. On the other hand, if the plan does come to fruition, it could make an Israeli-Egyptian dream come true. For Egypt, the plan holds the promise of an end to Hamas's cooperation with terror groups in Sinai, and it would give Egypt a way out of the closure it has imposed on Gaza and the possibility of operating the Gaza market to Egyptian goods. But Benjamin Netanyahu's government, the plan's key is the appointment of Dahlan, who is close to Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman as head of the state of Gaza. Right, so let me just finish off there. It says, thus, with all due caution, we can say that if the plan is implemented, it will ensure a fine profit for all sides, except for Abbas and Palestinian aspirations to establish a state. True, the plan leaves Hamas in control of security and doesn't demilitarize it, but Israel would have a partner in Gaza who supports reconciliation with Israel. Qatari and Turkish involvement would be neutralized in the Strip, while Egypt and the UAE, Israel's new friend, would shore up the agreement if it is breached. Whew. So there you are. Dear listeners, Hamas has to give in to either Mahmoud Abbas, which is game one, or to Mohammed Dahlan, which is game two. And Dahlan, who tried to take over the Gaza in 2007, is now going to try to come through the back door. So if it's either game one or game two, it's a win-win situation for Israel. Mahmoud Abbas is very, very cross because his rival, Mohammed Dahlan, seems to be winning. So, tug of war there, Mufti, tug of war. Mahmoud Abbas is throttling Gaza so that he can take control, and Mohammed Dahlan is trying to help Gaza so that he can take control. So, as I said, it's an absolute mess. It's a game of power, a game of thrones, and of course the people will suffer. Israel, of course, is just a spectator to all of this. And in the Middle East, Mufti, Muslims are doing a very, very fine job, pretty fine job at creating discord, division and suffering amongst themselves. So on this glorious Jummah day, let us make dua for all of them that they get some hidayat, inshallah.
Yes, certainly a tough situation for Hamas, and you very aptly gave us an overview of the entire conflict and also the present developments with regards to Dahlan. It was really informative. Now, light at the end of the tunnel.
Light at the end of the tunnel. Yes, let's see what I got for you today, very quickly. I think I got two for you. Okay. First is a recycled one. Chota Mota had a very bad hearing problem, Mufti, very bad hearing problem. So when he went to see his doctor for his annual checkup, he told the doctor, hey, you know, I can't hear anything, man, nothing. I can't hear hardly anything. So the doctor checked him out and fitted him with a hearing aid that was tiny, you know, the new hearing aids, very tiny, and you can hardly notice when somebody is wearing one. And a month later, Chota Mota went to the doctor again because he had a heavy flu. And the doctor asked, so, uncle, how is the hearing aid? Your family must be so happy now that they don't have to shout and speak to you very loudly and so on. And Chota Mota said, hey, doc, they don't even know that I got a hearing aid. I sit around and listen to them talking, what they are speaking to each other. And I changed my will 3 times already. Okay, one last one.
Yes, go ahead.
Donald Trump and his driver were cruising along a country road one night when all of a sudden they hit a pig and killed it instantly. And Donald Trump told his driver, you go up there to the farmhouse and explain to the owners what happened. Well, about an hour later, Trump sees his driver coming back to the car with a few packets. And he asked him, what happened to you? Trump asks him, what happened to you? And the driver replies, well, the farmer gave me some fresh strawberries and some bottles of honey, and his wife made me a big breakfast of eggs and steaks and coffee and croissants, and they also gave me a box of cigars. And Trump says, good heavens, what did you tell them? And the driver replies, I told them I'm Donald Trump's driver and I just killed the pig.
Killer one for the Friday morning. Jazakumullah khair. Thank you for your time this Friday morning. We appreciate it and look forward to you. In fact, no program next week, the following week after that, inshallah.
Well, actually, Maulana, I've got bad news for you because I'm off to glorious, wonderful, cultural Uzbekistan and Turkey, inshallah.
Inshallah. So that sounds like a really great trip, inshallah. The advert has been playing on the radio station, and it sounds like a fabulous one, inshallah. All the best for that.
Jazakallah khair, Habibi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.